I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Attorney General Eric Holder this morning defended his decision to try professed 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a federal court in New York. Appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Holder reiterated his belief that it's time for justice for the victims of 9/11 as well for the detainees, and that the U.S. need not cower in the face of this enemy. President Obama has said those who criticize the decision now will not find it offensive when Mohammed is convicted and given the death penalty. But Republican Charles Grassley of Iowa today took issue with the government's faith in a conviction.
I don't know how you can make a statement that failure to convict is not an option when you got juries in this country. I think a lot of Americans thought O.J. Simpson ought to be convicted of murder rather than being in jail for what he's in jail for now.
Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate magazine. Dahlia, were critics satisfied today? Did they still wonder why this was being held in a civilian court?
I don't imagine critics are satisfied. I think what Holder tried to do was go through point by point and say, look, all of the big hysteria we heard this weekend about how, you know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was going to be brought stateside and kind of turned into the Tasmanian devil and lethally destroy New York, and it would be, you know, there would be no way to control him, and it would be a font of hatred spewing. I mean, he tried to go through the really political questions of why he had done this. But I think that for the folks who really believe that this makes New York a target or that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed gets a big forum to spew hatred, I'm not sure Holder can offer the kinds of guarantees that they want to see. Because, look, we're going to trial, and juries do all sorts of things. So,
well, there was a sharp exchange between Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican of South Carolina, and Attorney Holder. Let's listen.
Can you give me a case in United States history where an enemy combatant caught on a battlefield was tried in civilian court?
I don't know. I'd have to look at that. I think that, you know, the determination I've made.
We're making history here, Mr. Attorney General. I'll answer it for you. The answer is no. Let's say we captured bin Laden tomorrow. Would he be entitled to Miranda warnings at the moment of capture?
Dahlia Lithwick, that wasn't the only tough question. Senator John Kyle of Arizona asked Holder about his statement that this is the best way to get a conviction. Kyle saying, well, Sheikh Mohammed has already confessed prior to, you know, torture. So why do you need to be in a civilian court to get a conviction? It would seem like an easy one. What was Holder's response to these questions?
The colloquy with Kyle was very funny. Kyle said that the delay, the 8-year delay in bringing these guys to justice was the consequence in part of leftist lawyers. And Holder was just sort of flummoxed. He said, wait a minute, there weren't leftist lawyers in the Bush administration for the 8 years that this was happening, and Congress has actually fixed the military commission system, and that's not a bunch of leftist lawyers either. So I think that the exchange with Kyle was one of the, you know, the ones that we're going to hear on the talk shows. But I think that Kyle's point that this has gone on for years and years is very unfair to lay at Eric Holder's door, because, of course, had the Bush administration put them in a system that already existed, either the existing military commission system or the existing criminal law system, we wouldn't have waited 8 years for justice. So I think to blame the Obama administration for the failure of the Bush administration to craft a legal system whereby these folks could be tried is a little bit unfair.
And Holder seemed to be saying that, you know, he's going to make this decision. He thinks it's the right decision. He's not going to let others dictate, and certainly not letting the accused dictate where they should be tried. But he had support. The committee chair, Patrick Leahy of Vermont, a Democrat, supported the move, as did Senator Dianne Feinstein. Just briefly, what did they say?
Well, I think they both said that we've tried it the other way. The other way doesn't work. These military commissions have been really an abject failure. There have only been 3 convictions in the military tribunal system where there's been dozens of convictions of people in regularly constituted Article III courts. Dianne Feinstein said, I thought really hard about this, and I'm sure that this is the way to bring these people to justice. I think both Dianne Feinstein and Pat Leahy really make the point that we've given this military commission system a shot. The Supreme Court continues to find it unconstitutional. Let's create a system that works, and that is regularly constituted civilian criminal courts.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor, legal correspondent for Slate magazine. Dahlia, thanks so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Next month, more than 190 countries will gather in Copenhagen. Their original goal was to come up with an agreement to curb global warming, an agreement that would replace the Kyoto Treaty when it expires in 2012. But as you've probably heard, world leaders, including President Obama, say a new treaty isn't likely yet. And the U.S. will also be going to Copenhagen without having passed mandatory caps on emissions here in the U.S., as the Senate climate bill has been put on hold. But there will still probably be fireworks in Denmark, with a debate over a dramatic shift in the international community's approach to global warming. Reporter Naomi Klein recently wrote about all this for Rolling Stone magazine. She joins us now. Naomi, welcome.
Thank you.
And you wrote about this in the recent Rolling Stone magazine. What's the shift you're talking about?
Well, what I'm writing about is climate debt, and it's an argument that is being made by a growing coalition of developing country governments, primarily in Latin America and in Africa, who are arguing that the best way to solve the climate crisis is for the rich world, the G8 countries, to pay reparations to the developing world who are actually not responsible for creating the climate crisis historically. If we look at this historically, the 200 years that carbon emissions have been building in the atmosphere.
Give us some of those stats. Developed countries represent less than 20% of the world's population, and what's their emission?
At least 75% of the accumulated carbon in the atmosphere. The United States, 5% of the world population, is responsible for 25% of the current emissions. And then on the flip side of that, if you look at who is on the front lines of climate change, where the effects of climate change are already being felt, where it isn't about projecting models into the future, but it is about the here and now, droughts, floods, those countries are overwhelmingly in the developing world. According to the World Bank, about 75 to 80% of the damages caused by global warming are in the developing world. So you have this direct inverse relationship between cause and effect, between who caused the crisis and who is living the effects.
And the World Bank, in fact, says the cost to developing countries of being, you know, the victims, if you will, of developed countries' emissions is about $100 billion a year. And just detail some of the ways you started to, but just some of the ways that developing countries are affected more than developed countries by climate issues.
Some of it is just simple geography. Sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, is particularly drought-prone. We've just seen an incredible monsoon season and cyclone season in the Philippines, anomalous storms. And the Philippines climate scientists do attribute this to climate change. So there's all kinds of costs associated with this. When you have more floods, you have more malaria, so there's treatment for that, costs associated with drought, and so on. So those are just the direct costs associated with climate change. But in addition to that, you have UN researchers who have estimated the cost of not just dealing with the effects of climate change, but shifting from economies based on dirty fuel to cleaner energy at being around $500 to $600 billion a year.
Right.
So the price tag on this is very, very high.
Right. So this idea of climate debt, a reparation, is not just a punishment for developed countries. It's seen by some as the only way that developing countries can afford to switch from old fossil fuels to cleaner alternatives because, as you said, that $500 billion price tag for them, it would be impossible.
The point of making the argument in framing it as debt is that countries like the Maldives, Bangladesh, who are really on the front lines of this crisis, you know, the Maldives, they recently had a cabinet meeting underwater to make the point that if we don't do anything about climate change, their country's going to disappear. They don't want to be coming to these summits cap in hand and saying, please, please, we want charity, we want aid. They're coming making a legal argument, and the legal argument is a familiar one. It's polluter pays. You know, we are responsible. It is our emissions. They don't just affect us. They have global implications, and these countries are just being hit first. Hmm. And that's just a cruel twist of geography. I mean, the fact of the matter is the U.S. and Canada both will experience some benefit from climate change under certain models. We'll have longer growing seasons. Now, obviously, there are parts of the United States that will be hit very hard, but there are other parts that will experience benefits. So we don't feel the same urgency that people in other parts of the world are feeling about this crisis. And that's why the piece in Rolling Stone is called Climate Rage, because I think increasingly we're seeing a less sort of green and fuzzy and crunchy environmental movement. We're seeing an environmental movement that is saying that this looks like a war that's being waged by the rich against the poor.
Well, we touched on this recently. We reported here on companies like GM buying up trees in Brazil to try to offset there the company's carbon emissions here, or to turn those trees and carbon offsets into commodities to try and buy and sell them to other companies that might need them. And that is outraging some developing countries who say it's doing nothing to force big polluters to change their ways if they can afford to buy and sell these credits. So there is a lot of outrage at the direction that the U.S. and other countries are going in, this idea of carbon offsets.
You know, that's been building over the past few years, but I think compounding it is the experience of the financial meltdown, because carbon trading and carbon offsets bear some remarkable similarities to the trade in derivatives. They're calling it the climate casino. The orthodoxy over the past decade around climate has been, let's leave it to the market. We need to find market-based solutions to climate change. And in a sense, I think it's positive collateral damage of the financial crisis that people are saying, wait a minute, we don't think Goldman Sachs should be in charge of our response to climate change. And that's not just rhetoric. Goldman Sachs is one of the companies that's most eager to get into the carbon trading business.
Well, the call for climate debt reparations began with environmental groups, and it was really coalesced by Angelica Navarro of Bolivia. She was the first government official to call for it. We understand now 49 governments are going to take this demand to talks in Copenhagen. And there is a model for how they want it to work. It's Ecuador's Yasuni National Park. Tell us about this beautiful Amazonian rainforest and how Ecuador's president is sort of using that as a bargaining chip.
There are more species of trees in 1 hectare of the Yasuni National Park than in all of North America. It's also home to many indigenous peoples and many endangered species.
And it's home to an estimated $7 billion worth of crude oil reserves.
Exactly. And oil companies are salivating to get that oil out of the ground. Ecuador's government started making deals with oil companies to extract this oil. And there were standoffs with indigenous groups in Ecuador. And they came up with a compromise that's now being championed by Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa. He doesn't want to extract that oil and have the carbon emissions associated with it. He wants to protect this wilderness. But he doesn't think that the people of Ecuador should have to pay the cost. He says Ecuador needs this money for health care, for education, and also to transition to a green economy. So he says that the rich world that created the climate crisis should pay Ecuador to leave the oil in the ground, making the argument that we all benefit from not having those emissions and also from protecting this piece of wilderness that, you know, is unparalleled in the world. Gordon Brown loves the idea. The Clinton Initiative is championing it as well. The way they're trying to finance it creates a precedent of how to use climate debt to reduce emissions.
But there are questions. Is that eco-extortion? We're talking with Naomi Klein, who recently wrote in Rolling Stone magazine about climate debt. Rich countries paying countries like Ecuador so they can keep places like the Yasuni National Forest intact and develop alternative fuels. We'll continue with Naomi after a break, and later, warnings about reverse mortgages. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with journalist Naomi Klein about climate debt and what she calls climate rage in a recent edition of Rolling Stone magazine. The rage from developing nations who want the industrialized world to pay for the longtime role in climate change. And Naomi, before the break, we were talking about the $7 billion worth of oil reserves beneath Ecuador's Yasuni National Park and Ecuador's president's offer to leave that oil in the ground if the industrialized countries pay him $3.5 billion. Some in the West are worried that this is eco-extortion. We've heard about this also in the case of trees, poorer countries saying, we won't cut down our trees if rich countries pay us not to. So your thoughts on that?
I think the idea of calling it extortion belittles the urgency that Ecuador faces. They are an oil-producing nation. This is their main export. For them to forego that oil tangibly means fewer schools, fewer hospitals. So because they didn't create the climate crisis, why should they have to make those sacrifices? This is a shared problem.
Well, how does it get shared, this idea of charging countries for their climate debt? How do you decide who owes what? It would be like the industrialized nation sitting down after a huge dinner and figuring out, you know, who pays what part of the bill.
That's a good analogy. And one of the issues on the agenda in Copenhagen has always been financing for the developing world. There is a debate about what you call it. President Obama has made the argument that the U.S. has a historical responsibility, but obviously he stopped short of calling it a debt because there are all kinds of legal implications associated with that. I don't think it would be that hard to come up with calculations because we do have the science for who emitted what when. I mean, there's a huge body of knowledge about this, but I think that there's broader political debates about who really should foot the bill. I mean, should it be taxpayers in the United States, or should it be the oil companies in the United States? Should it be regular people, or should it be the corporations?
Is it that easy to divide up country to country? Because we understand countries like China and India, with huge growing economies producing large amounts of carbon, they want reparations too.
Absolutely. That does complicate it. But the argument that they are making is that, yes, China is emitting now at levels that they must reduce, but China didn't create the crisis because it's only relatively recently that these high emissions have ramped up. However, I think it's a very good sign that we're hearing from the big developing countries that are responsible now for significant emissions. And here we're not talking about a huge number of countries. We're talking about China, India, South Africa, Mexico, Brazil, a handful of very large, rapidly developing countries. And all of them are saying, we are willing to cut, we are willing to change, but we need this acknowledgement of historical responsibility from the developed world.
Finally, as you mentioned, your article in Rolling Stone was entitled Climate Rage. You know, quote people like Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. He says it's real and it could, this anger, this rage, could crystallize into something. What was his fear?
Well, I think it is happening right now, and I think it's an angry week because there was so much hype about Copenhagen in the lead-up from world leaders saying this is our last chance to save the world, really talking about the stakes. You know, we don't have endless amounts of time to really change our economic model. And now we're hearing, actually, we have plenty of time. It's just one meeting. We're not going to come up with a real deal in Copenhagen. We'll just start the process. I mean, imagine how that sounds. You know, if you are in Bangladesh facing more and more of these floods, if you are in the Philippines and you've seen these historic cyclones, it's inevitable that there will be a backlash because we clearly don't feel the same urgency. And we see this in the statistics. We're actually, the number of Americans who believe that climate change is real and a problem is actually dropping.
Well, and you remind us that was it the U.S. military that did a study that said that climate change was a matter of national security?
And it's expensive. I mean, this is the other argument I'm making in the piece is that, okay, you know, we've talked about numbers that are pretty staggering, $100 billion a year to help countries deal with climate change, $500 billion a year to help countries leapfrog over dirty fossil fuel energies and to cleaner energies. But then you read these studies produced by the Navy, the Pentagon, and they've been coming out every couple of years. They're talking about increasing numbers of resource wars, a link between terrorism and climate change, the threat of huge migrations of people wanting to come to countries that are less affected by climate change, having to build fortresses against these migrants. I don't agree with the politics of building fortress continents to protect ourselves from a crisis of our own making. But regardless of whether you agree with that strategy or not, it's not cheap to build a fortress around your continent. It's not cheap to be waging these resource wars, as we know. So there is no scenario that doesn't cost. And the question is, are we going to invest in people? Are we going to invest in alternative energy? Are we going to invest in wars and fortresses?
I just want to underscore that report came from the Pentagon in 2003. It predicted that the U.S. and other rich nations would likely decide to build defensive fortresses around their countries because of climate refugees fleeing their countries or regions becoming unstable because of climate issues and leading to insurgencies and warlords. So obviously they think it's a matter of national security. And again, what would the costs be? What's the estimate of what, for instance, the U.S. climate debt would be?
Well, it hasn't been broken down by country yet, but the estimated cost of helping the developing world adapt to climate change is $100 billion a year, and that would be divided between all of the developed countries. And generally, it's argued that it would be divided by population and emission level. This is what they're arguing about right now, about the share of the EU, the share of Australia, the share of the U.S. That's one of the issues that's going to be coming up in Copenhagen.
Well, and Naomi Klein, you say it is going to come up. It's going to be right on the front burner. She's talking about reparations, rich nations paying poorer nations for all the emissions that they've produced and thereby helping poorer nations move from fossil fuels to alternatives. Her article, Climate Rage, appears in the November 12th issue of Rolling Stone. She's also author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. For more on that, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Naomi, thanks for the primer.
Thank you so much, Robin. It was great talking with you.
Okay, let's look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman. He's taken his camera into mental institutions and state legislatures. Now he's backstage and on stage with the Paris Opera Ballet. We'll hear what he found. Still ahead today, author Barbara Kingsolver with a novel that includes homeless World War I veterans, Mexican artist Frida Kahlo, and communist Leon Trotsky. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. To Afghanistan now, where security forces increased patrols and helicopter flyovers today ahead of tomorrow's inauguration of President Hamid Karzai. Karzai won a second term last month by default after his rival, Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, pulled out of a re-election. The re-election was scheduled after Karzai's victory in the first round of voting in August was found to be fraudulent. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in Afghanistan today and will attend tomorrow's ceremony. She'll also meet with the top U.S. military commander there, General Stanley McChrystal, who's asked the White House to commit more troops to the war. In the meantime, Germany has said it will extend its Afghan mission for another year. The war is becoming increasingly unpopular with the German public. More than 30 German soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan as Taliban militants become more entrenched in the north of the country, where the bulk of Germany's troops are stationed. Germany and others in the international community have been pressing Karzai to tackle corruption in his government, a concern that many Afghans have as well. Well, the BBC's Martin Patience took a sampling of public opinion at Kabul's main bus station.
There's a sea of yellow taxis and white minibuses traveling from the capital to the eastern provinces of Khost, Pakti and Paktika. You can get a pretty good sense of what's happening across the country here. And with the inauguration of President Karzai, the people have pretty strong opinions about what they'd like him to do during his second term.
A country with a corruption is nothing. If they will arrest a thief, that instead of to give them punished, he will pay and then he will be released. But if there's no corruptions, I mean, that government will be the people government, people will like it, and people will support it. And the government, without corruption, it will be a good security, everything will be going well.
A second passenger tells me that he wants the government to start controlling food prices, but he says that the West won't allow the Afghan government to do this. And as with every good bus station, there's a selection of shops and restaurants here. Cigarettes and biscuits can be bought, and one of the restaurants is serving up fried meat, rice and vegetables.
I think the President Karzai is doing an okay job, but the problem is with his cabinet. They're a bunch of thieves. They steal everything they can. We have made some progress, though. New roads have been built. But this country has many resources, such as minerals, and we need to work to exploit them.
At the back of the station, car bonnets are up, oil is being checked, and tyres are being changed. Most of the drivers try and do the checks and repairs themselves, but if they're having trouble, there's always help on hand. Who's got the authority in this country? Is it the government or is it the Taliban? Who's better?
Well, I'm supporting both sides, I mean, government and Taliban. Taliban's also my brothers, so they are the same blood that I have.
But would you like to see them both working together? Do you think that would be the best government if the Taliban were in it, working alongside Hamid Karzai?
Yeah, if they work together, Taliban and government, they will be one power, they will work a lot.
What is your name?
My name is Hamed. My father named Jumagol.
If President Karzai came here, what would you like to tell him? He tells me that the sons of rich men go to schools with nice chairs, eat nice food, and wear nice clothes. So if the president provides good schools, then one day you could be president. Yes, he says, if I go to a good school, then I could be really something in the future.
That report from the BBC's Martin Patience in Kabul, Afghanistan. A little housekeeping here. Just a reminder, you can listen to our show stream live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can always download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go, hereandnow.org. Up next, reverse mortgages. They've helped some seniors stay in their homes, but borrower, beware. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. So far this year, a record number of senior homeowners who want to continue living at home but who need some extra cash to cover expenses have turned to reverse mortgages. In regular mortgages, you pay the lender. In reverse mortgages, they pay you. There are various kinds, some from the government for people in hardship, some backed by the government through banks or other lenders. But they give you a tax-free loan. You stay in the home, and that loan is then paid back when you sell the home or your heirs sell it when you die. But as reverse mortgages have become more common, so have abuses and abusers. In fact, the National Consumer Law Center says seniors are now facing some of the same kind of predatory lending practices that took place over the past few years during the subprime lending boom. So let's turn to an expert. Joining us on the line is Barbara Stuckey. She's vice president of the Reverse Mortgage Counseling Services Network and the Home Equity Initiative at the National Council on Aging, and joins us from San Diego. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you.
And you're there to address the National Reverse Mortgages Lenders Association annual meeting.
Yes, indeed.
Is abusive lending on the radar there?
Thank you.
And you're there to address the National Reverse Mortgages Lenders Association annual meeting.
Yes, indeed.
Is abusive lending on the radar there?
I think so. I think everyone is concerned about the fact that seniors make the best use of what, for many, is their most valuable asset.
And so we want to make sure that happens. Well, let's start by giving us a thumbnail sketch on just how reverse mortgages work.
I think most people are familiar with a conventional loan, as you mentioned, where you make monthly payments and you build up your equity over time. With a reverse, the idea is that you can draw upon the equity that you have built up for many years by taking out these loans. There are many different ways in which you can receive the money, either as a lump sum, a line of credit, or as a regular monthly payment.
And you retain the title of your home when you do this?
Absolutely. Everybody who is on title continues to be a homeowner.
And you get these reverse mortgages from?
There are many different outlets that offer these reverse mortgages. It's important to remember that today almost all reverse mortgages are, in fact, home equity conversion mortgages. This is an FHA loan.
So it's backed by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. They're called HECMs, we've heard. And can anyone take one of those out?
In order to qualify, you have to be at least age 62. You have to be a homeowner. It's best to have a modest or no mortgage on the home, but if you have one, you have to use a portion of the proceeds to pay off that amount first, and whatever's left over, you can then use for additional cash.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying you can only use the money after you've paid off your mortgage?
Right. Let's say you own $30,000. You still have a mortgage of $30,000. If the lender is willing to give you $100,000, you take $30,000. You pay off your old lender, and you have $70,000 left.
So if you have like a $300,000 mortgage,
it doesn't work.
Unless you want to take $400,000 out, pay off your mortgage so you don't have monthly payments, and then pay back the bank in 20 years when you sell the house.
Right. What you're doing is you're paying off your existing mortgage, you're transferring that debt into a reverse mortgage, and then you're deferring the payments on that.
Right.
And so the idea is that frees up that monthly income for
right.
some families, and that may be enough. the real advantage of a reverse is that you don't have to make those monthly payments, and that helps protect a person against foreclosure should their ability, you know, their income change over time, either mm-hmm. because they have more expenses or their health declines.
Oh, okay. And in the FHA-backed loans, there are caps on how much seniors can borrow. It was recently raised to $625,000?
That's right.
Right. Well, but then problems arise with fees and interest rates and things that maybe you might not see in the small print. So let's look at that. First of all, it's now required that people get counseling, but that's just a $125 fee. But there is something also called an origination fee. What's that?
Most of the fees that are associated with reverse mortgages are similar to those with conventional loans. You pay a fee to the lender in order to originate the loan. Right now, that is capped at $6,000.
That seems like a lot of money, but as you've said, if you are expecting to get maybe $70,000 in a lump sum or a line of credit or monthly payments, $6,000 might be worth it.
That's right. Another typical payment that reverse mortgage borrowers are going to make is to pay mortgage insurance, and that goes to the FHA. And that helps pay for a unique consumer protection. It ensures that if the value of the loan, the amount that you owe, is greater than the value of your home, either because the amount has grown large over time or because the home has declined over time, that when the senior sells their house and repays the loan, that they don't owe more than the value of the home.
Well, that was going to be our question, because let's say you take it out at 62 and you live another 20 years, and you took out a loan of, let's say, $300,000, you're well under the cap, but your home, when you finally sell it in 20 years and move into, you know, maybe assisted living, is only worth $250,000. So you don't have to pay that whole $300,000 back?
That's right. If you sell the house to pay off the loan, you don't have to do that. If a person were to die and the heirs wanted to keep the house, then they would have to pay back the full amount take out a loan for that amount. It's not something you're going to get with any other kind of loan or credit
right.
card. You have to pay back what you owe.
But then there's the other problem, which is interest rates. In some of these reverse mortgage loans, they can be sliding. And doesn't that get us into the same problem we saw happen in the subprime market, which is someone might take out a loan now, a reverse mortgage loan, but then when that interest rate shoots up, suddenly that loan is huge.
Absolutely. It is a risk. They are adjustable for the most part. There are some fixed rate loans, so there is the option of getting a fixed rate loan, but there are other requirements for doing that. And I think that's the reason why people have to be very thoughtful about making sure they understand why they need the money. There are programs available if they just need to fix the roof or if they just have some other tax problem. There may be other alternatives that may be more appropriate for their situation.
Right. We also note last year Congress imposed some new rules on lenders. They can't do what's called cross-selling, try to sell you other financial products along with your reverse mortgage. And also beware of lenders who are calling reverse mortgages lifetime income.
Right. I think reverse mortgages make a lot of sense to help kind of act as a financial glue, to help fill gaps, to help people keep small challenges from becoming big problems. So yeah. Rather than waiting until the house has a big problem, that you can fix that roof right away. And that's the real advantage of this type of a loan.
Not living off it. Barbara Stuckey, Vice President of the Reverse Mortgage Counseling Services Network and the Home Equity Initiative at the National Council on Aging. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Author Barbara Kingsolver has written an epic novel around the idea of missing parts to various puzzles. It's called The Lacuna, which in Latin means gap or missing part, like the hole in a cave.
Today, the lacuna appeared a little below the surface. It's near the center of the cliff, below a knob where a hummock of grass grows out. It should be easy to find again, but best to look early, with sun just up and the tide low. Inside the tunnel, it was very cold and dark again, but a blue light showed up faintly like a fogged window farther back. It must be the other end. No devil back there, but a place to come up on the other side, a passage. But too far to swim, and too frightening. One day, Piltzintecutli will say, "Go ahead, lucky boy. Vete rubio. Swim toward that light. Go find the other side of the world where you belong."
And the boy does. Harrison Shepard goes back and forth between his father, a Washington bureaucrat, and his mother, a faded Mexican dancer. Through his eyes, we watch history. The 1932 Bonus Riots, during which the U.S. Army attacked homeless veterans demanding their benefits. The communist movement in Mexico, where Harrison becomes a cook and plaster mixer for the politically active artist Diego Rivera and his wife Frida Kahlo. And where he witnesses the murder of their house guest, the exiled communist leader Leon Trotsky. Finally, back in Asheville, North Carolina, we see the paranoia of McCarthyism. This is Barbara Kingsolver's first novel in 9 years. Her most recent work was the nonfiction Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life, her family's year of eating locally grown food. And Barbara joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
It's one of those times where I almost have to say goodbye because it takes so long. What a read. You know, we just ricochet from place to place and also linger, I should say, very lyrical and mystical in places. Why are we doing this span of time?
I'm fascinated with character, both individual, personal character, and in this case, national character. And in those moments of history that turn everything on its head. And I've long had a hunch that this moment of time between World War II and 1950 was pivotal to the American identity.
But before we get to World War II in the book, we're in Mexico with this young man, you know, mixing plaster and making pan dulce, sweetbreads. How do you say that?
Yes.
Yep, for Diego Rivera and his wife and their house guest, Leon Trotsky. I thought, what a great idea to make someone a fly on that wall.
The most wonderful thing a novel can do is make the truth personal, make history personal in this case. So this kid who grows up in these very sort of sad and strange circumstances in southern Mexico is the vehicle to get you into a lot of fascinating places.
The one small criticism I've read of the book was in the LA Times that Trotsky does come off, as they write, as a social democratic Santa Claus. Did you worry about that maybe he came off as a little too much as just a house guest?
Well, not a bit, because I have the historical record. Everything Trotsky says in this novel about his own politics came straight from Trotsky's mouth, his intention to make the Soviet Revolution a democratic one. I've always thought that was fascinating. He was also a very kind and much loved by the people around him in his last years in Mexico, in spite of the fact that Stalin had really killed every person who had ever been meaningful to him, and he still bore up. I thought that was remarkable. Trotsky himself is a lacuna. He has been erased from history, and many of the events in this novel have also been removed from memory.
Well, I'm thinking of the Bonus Riots in the middle of Washington, D.C., homeless encampments, World War I vets living with their families right there in the middle of D.C.
These men were promised a bonus. It was essentially their army pay. And then Congress reneged on the promise, said, whoops, we changed our minds. You can wait for your pay until you retire. So there were thousands of homeless veterans who had no place to go. So they came to Washington, D.C. to complain about it, and this was how they were treated. There are many things in this piece of history that seem quite relevant to the moment, very current. So it was a fascinating process to uncover these pieces of history.
So in this case, did you discover the Bonus Riots or rediscover them perhaps and get deep into what happened and also learn more about Trotsky's brutal, bloody murder in Mexico and then say, how can I connect these with a story?
I did know a lot about Trotsky. The Bonus Riots were completely new to me. I didn't know about that. I discovered amazing things in the process of researching this novel. For example, when the second half of the novel takes place in Asheville, North Carolina, and I discovered that in 1947, one of the sort of the, towards the end of my novel, when things are getting very claustrophobic, and I was trying to kind of generate this air of claustrophobia when neighbors were spying on neighbors and very worried about what everyone would think and feeling closed in and shutting their shutters, and I learned from reading the newspapers that the whole city went under quarantine from polio. That was perfect for the purposes of my plot because it just added to this sensation of being closed in. I kept finding pieces of history that were absolutely news to me that worked perfectly with my plot.
Well, speaking of which, is there really a Hindu with 600 pins inserted in his body, two skewers through his abdomen, one through his tongue, and it takes him an hour and a half every morning to dress, which your protagonist reads in a National Geographic?
This came straight from a National Geographic. The character at this point is a little boy, and I was trying to get into the head of a little boy, and he's, you know, he's very interested in newspapers and magazines, and I just imagined him kind of stealing glances at what's on the newsstand. And I have in the archives all of the National Geographics running back to that time. And so I myself was paging through, and I thought, this would grab the attention of a 13-year-old boy.
We have to ask you about food because you've written so beautifully about it, and you do in this book. And there's sometimes page after page, especially in the beginning when Harrison is learning to be a cook in Mexico. And for instance, here's directions for making empanadas dulces. They can be triangular or curled like snails with a filling inside. The dough is the same either way. White flour with lard and a little salt rubbed in. Beat egg yolks with a little cold water, as many eggs as the housekeeper would spare. Then mix the liquid lake in the volcano of flour, exactly like mixing plaster, which he does for the artists. It makes you want to get like a marble, you know, countertop. We know you love food because of your writing about local food and the tech, you know, being really having hands on the food you eat as opposed to processed food. But why so much in this?
Food speaks directly through the back of our brains to our hearts, I think. It's olfactory. You know, you smell it, you taste it. And the task of the novelist is to bring the reader all of the details that make a place real. It's easy to concentrate on the visual, but the best way to relay experience is through all the senses. And because this kid is a cook and he's making these wonderful foods, and I thought, well, as long as you're reading this, you might as well enjoy the details. You might as well get a taste of what he's doing. I've always thought that the least I could do with every novel is give people something useful, ideally a recipe. So here are several, in fact. And if the book makes you hungry, so much the better.
Barbara Kingsolver, the book is The Lacuna. Barbara, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.